back out.
Oh, we're in.
Double tap.
Yeah. You gotta make sure he's dead. Make sure we're dead. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:33 p.m. on Tuesday, April 16th. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Betrovich in the Capitol. Members present today are Senator Dunbar, Senator Vice Chair Kaufman, Senator Tobin, myself, Senator Wilson. We are expecting Senator Giesel, who's coming back from other state business. We do have a quorum to conduct business this afternoon. We have two items on the agenda. First up, we have HB 17, Contraceptives Coverage Insurance Medical Assistance by Representative Carrick, who's here in the room. We'll invite her to the desk here to start her presentation. We also have our second item of business is Senate Bill 219, Prior Authorization Exempt for Healthcare Providers from Senator Wilson's office, my office. First, we have Senate Bill 17, Rep. Carrick, and Ms. Bowman, please come to the testifier table. We first held a hearing and took invited and public testimony to the Senate Companion, Senate Bill 27 by Senator Tobin on March 12th. We do have Rep. Carrick and Ms. Staff, Sherry Bowman, here at the table to provide us a reintroduction of this bill, provide a quick sexual analysis of this bill. And we also have folks online. We have Charles Slimming, the pharmacist from the Division of Healthcare Services, for questions. And we also in the room have the esteemed Director Lori Winghier from the Division of Insurance from DCCED. In the room for questions. Representative Carrick, the floor is yours. If you want to introduce yourself and place yourself, and you may begin when you're ready.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. And thank you to the chair and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. So this afternoon, I'm very pleased to bring you House Bill 17, and I just want to thank everybody for hearing the bill. And I do know that folks have already had a chance to hear the Senate Companion, Senate Bill 27. So just to recap, I want to reiterate that this is an insurance bill. It mandates coverage for insurance of up to 12 months for prescription contraceptives to be dispersed at one time. Providers can already write a prescription for a 12-month supply of contraceptives, and it would still be under this legislation the provider's prerogative whether to provide that prescription or not. The purpose of the bill is to reduce access to contraceptives that happen often at the pharmacy counter. When an individual goes to pick up their prescription, ensuring that they do have insurance coverage and can fulfill the prescription their provider has already given them. This legislation helps to reduce unintended pregnancies and contributes to responsible family planning. My staff, Sherry Bowman, has been an excellent resource to me, and she is able to walk through a brief summary of changes from what the committee has previously seen in Senate Bill 27 to what is here in House Bill 17. I just want to also note that we have Director Winghier here with the Division of Insurance to help answer any specific questions that the committee might have that we may not be able to.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Bowman, and I am staff to Representative Carrick. And I'm going to go through some of the summary of changes, specifically from version A to version B, since it is quite different from the Senate Companion 27 version. So on page 1, line 10 of version A, we just added some language. But on page 1, lines 11 through 14, we deleted the section beginning with emergency contraception. So all of that language has been deleted. And again, that happens on page 7, lines 3 to 6. Now, this is version A to version B. And it excludes all references to emergency contraception.
We're going to take a brief recess.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wilson. Again, for the record, this is Sherry Bowman, staff to Representative Carrick. And now I will go through the explanation of changes from version BA to version U.
At ease. All righty. Thank you, Ms. Bowman. At this time, we will go ahead and open public testimony for House Bill 17. Is anyone here in the room of Juneau wish to testify on House Bill 17? Seeing none. And we do have one person online to testify to Senate Bill 17. We'll call Ms. Sonia Kumar.
Hi, yeah, I'm Sonia. I live in Juneau, and I'm calling on behalf of myself. I'm calling in support of HB 17. As a former seasonal worker who has worked field jobs in remote national wildlife refuges, living and working in new towns or in states every 3 to 6 months, it would have been so helpful to have had the access to get a full year's worth of birth control while doing field work. I didn't always have access to a doctor or even a pharmacy while working remotely, and skipping a month of birth control would radically mess up my hormones. There are so many seasonal and remote workers in Alaska throughout the year, a lot of times in the summertime, and for them to have the ability to get a full year of birth control would be so beneficial. So, yes, again, I'm calling in support of HB 17. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Rose Titus. Rose, if you could put yourself on the record and take a couple of minutes to give your testimony on HB 17.
Hi, Rose Titus calling from Anchorage. I'm calling in support of this bill. I think that this is important because in Alaska, there are many rural villages that do not have regular access to medical care, nor do they have regular access to receiving mail if the weather is bad, if, say, it just doesn't arrive for weeks at a time. This could definitely help people in those villages who need regular access to their medications without risking potential side effects if they can get it 1 month and then not the next. This is also important for people that do live in cities, as we are currently facing major staffing issues with pharmacies, so your ability to get any medication may be complicated. You could be waiting days, weeks, months even for something with some back order, or show up to a pharmacy to find out that it's closed. This could definitely help facilitate better care for patients across Alaska.
All right. Thank you, Rose, for your testimony. We have Steve Ramos. Did not know if you're just online for questions or if you're going to provide a testimony this afternoon.
Just questions.
All right. Thank you. He's our acting chief health administrator for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And seeing no one else online to testify and no one else here in the room to Juneau, we will go ahead and close public testimony. Feel free to email the Senate Health Committee if you would like to provide written comments to shss@akleg.gov. We'll go ahead and close public testimony on HB 17. We do believe we have a CS to adopt, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of work draft 33-LS0222/U as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of the conversation. Ms. Bowman, if you'd like to go ahead and go through the changes in the CS.
Oh, thank you, Chair Wilson. Again, for the record, I'm Sherry Bowman, staff to Representative Carrick, and I will walk through the explanation of changes from version BA to version U. And so on page three, lines 19 through 26, under the newly added section 2 of version BA, it added language to clarify religious exemptions. On page 3, lines 14 through 21, the committee substitute includes this language under section 1 and removes the reference to, quote unquote, a person's health care, and instead focuses the legislation on health care insurance coverage regarding contraceptive methods. We requested this change due to a legal memorandum that we received that you should have received today.
And we'll take a brief at ease here. We are back on the record, and before the IDs, just want to acknowledge we were joined by Senator Geisel and Ms. Bowman. We now have the changes from version BA to version U in front of the committee. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. Again, for the record, my name is Sherry Bowman. I'm staff to Representative Carrick. And I already went through the first change from version BA, which had added language to clarify religious exemptions. And so the committee substitute includes this language under Section 1, removes the reference to a person's health care, and focuses the legislation on health care insurance coverage regarding contraceptive methods. And that was per some legal guidance that we received, that original provision was just too broad. The next two changes were requested by the Department of Health. And so on page 7, lines 22, 25, 29, and 31 under Section 8, it regards the conditional effective date, and the committee substitute removes the references to Section 6 and replaces them with the correct references to Section 7. And the next change is on page 7, line 26, and it changes the conditional effective date from January 1st, 2025 to January 1st, 2026. And that concludes the explanation of changes.
Thank you. Are there questions on this version? Senator Geisel, then followed by Senator Dunbar.
So I'm looking at page 7. I'm still seeing Section 6 referred to in the conditional effects. Conditional effect notification, page 7. Am I on, and this is version U, I'm just making sure I got the right. I'm seeing Section 6 1, 2, 3 times here. I don't see Section 7 noticed. Am I missing something? I see Section 7. Pardon me. The references in to Section 7.
Yeah. I don't even see 20.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel. Yes. Could you clarify, are we looking in Section 7, page 7 of version U?
Pardon me, I'm looking at Section 8. Pardon me. That's the explanation. Thank you.
Ah, okay.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Dunbar.
I'm still trying to figure out how Senator Geisel is wrong, because I am looking at the I think she's right. I'm looking at the things, and it seems like there's...
Well, that's true. It says under Section...
Because, like, line 22, for example, there's nothing there. It's almost like it's referencing the prior document, perhaps. But I have, while they're figuring out the technical aspect, I kind of wanted to ask the bill sponsor to sort of try to put it in, you know, vernacular, kind of the changes that were made. It looks like when we went from Alpha to Bravo, it looked like there was removal of emergency contraception. That was the largest substantive change. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, yes. So then, just to walk through in layman's terms, what's taken place with House Bill 17 is we have on version U removed emergency contraception language from the legislation. On the floor of the House, there was an amendment that was adopted, which added religious exemption provisions. And that is reflected in version B.A. Mm-hmm. So version B.A includes a religious exemption provision that upon speaking with Ledge Legal was broader than I think the intent spoken to on the floor even was of the offer of that amendment. The intent was to provide religious exemption for employers or insurers based on contraceptive method. And so we wanted to make sure the language was cinched back down to reflect that intent. The language as it was passed on the floor was broad enough to encompass all healthcare coverage. And just to be clear to the committee members, religious exemption language does exist at the federal level. This was to add additional language at the state level to add duplicity to that in case those federal language has ever changed. And so we have worked with Ledge Legal to figure out a way to still capture the spirit and the intent of that amendment that was adopted on the floor while not making it broader than what the intent of that amendment was.
Senator Dunbar.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my sort of assertion, was that going from A to B, they removed emergency contraception, and then going from B to U, there was a refining of the religious exemption. And those are the substantive changes, and the rest are sort of technical changes. And the bill as a whole is largely unchanged from the version we've heard here before. Would you say that's the case?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, that is correct. The other changes that were requested by the Department of Health.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Well, it looks like we need to have some corrective drafting error that happened in the CS, and we will definitely put another CS before the committee to try to fix that with the bill sponsors' recommendations and changes one more time.
Well, unless it's a summary of changes that are incorrect.
I think, to the chair, that the drafting is correct. The summary of changes is just not quite numbered correctly, and we can certainly update that. I thank Senator Giesel for taking notice of that. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll definitely look into that. With that, I will remove my objection to adopting the CS as version U before the committee. Is there further objection to adopting version U? Seeing none, version U has been adopted before the committee. At this time, we will set House Bill 17 aside as we work through to make sure that everything is correct and bring this back before the committee, and we'll set an amendment deadline for this bill on, we'll say, next Monday at noon to bring before the committee on the following Tuesday. And I'd send that out to the committee members, but it'd be Monday, the next Monday at noon for HB 17. This time we'll take a brief at ease as we transition, and we'll set this bill aside. And have any further comments from the committee for the bill sponsor before we do so?
I think we're all set, Mr. Chair. Just thank the committee for hearing this bill and the couple of changes that were made between the versions, and look forward to working with anybody if there are any other changes other than just the small technical things to fix in the summary of changes.
All right. Thank you. And that Monday is April 22nd, April 22nd at noon. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease as we transition to Senate Bill 219. All right, we are back on the record. Our next item of business this afternoon is Senate Bill 219. This is prior auth exemption for healthcare providers for my office, Senator Wilson's office. Here at the table is Ms. Funoff, who's here to present a quick overview of this piece of legislation. Also go through a sexual analysis, and our intent is to take invited and public testimony and set this bill aside for further consideration this afternoon. Ms. Monoff, the floor is yours. If you can place yourself on the record, you may begin when you're ready.
Hi, thank you. For the record, Julia Fonov, staff to Senator Wilson, and through the chair, SB 219 aims to reduce the wait time for Alaskans to access healthcare services by exempting pre-authorization requirements for qualified healthcare providers. And currently, Alaskans must wait days or weeks for the processing time between the healthcare provider and insurance companies for pre-authorization delaying critical healthcare services. With this bill, a healthcare provider that has had 80% or more of prior authorization requests approved for certain healthcare services in the most recent 12-month period can be exempted from pre-authorization requirements. The exemption is granted to providers who have a proven track record of approved authorization requests, ensuring that only reliable providers are exempted. SB 219 is designed to ensure Alaskans have access to fast, efficient, and quality healthcare services when they need it most, without waiting for a pre-authorization process that could cause their health to decline even more. And if it is the will of the committee, I will go through the sectional analysis.
Please, thank you.
Great. For the record, Julia Fonov, staff to Senator Wilson, through the chair. Section 1 amends our insurance statutes, AS21, under regulations relating to healthcare insurance policies, with amending Section A1, which adds processes for the Director of Insurance to adopt regulations, standards, and criteria for utilization review entities, which are individuals that perform prior authorization. The next section lays out the requirements for providers exempted from prior authorization. So Section 2 adds a new section called Utilization Review Entities to our insurance statutes. Add Section A, which says utilization review entities may not require healthcare providers to complete prior authorization for a covered person to receive coverage if, during the most recent 12-month period, at least 80% of prior authorization requests submitted by the provider for that healthcare service has been or would have been approved. Add Section B, which says utilization review entities may evaluate whether healthcare providers continue to qualify for an exemption not more than once every 12 months. Utilization review entities are not required to evaluate an existing exemption and may establish a longer exemption period. Add Section C that states healthcare providers do not have to request an exemption to qualify for an exemption. Add Section D for if a healthcare provider is denied an exemption, they may request once every 12 months evidence from utilization review entities on why they were denied an exemption. This allows the healthcare provider to appeal the denial. Add Section E to allow utilization review entities to revoke an exemption after 12 months if, one, the healthcare provider does not meet the 80% approval criteria, two, they provide the healthcare provider with the information used to determine revoking the exemption, and three, they provide an explanation to the healthcare provider on how to appeal the decision. Add Section F, which requires the exemption remain in effect until 30 days after the prior authorization entity notifies the healthcare provider of its decision to revoke the exemption. Add Section G, that requires the decision to revoke an exemption by a prior authorization entity must be made by a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska with the same or similar specialty as the healthcare provider being considered for an exemption and must have experience providing the healthcare service for which the requested exemption applies. Add Section H, which says utilization review entities must provide a healthcare provider who receives an exemption with a notice that includes, one, a statement that the healthcare provider qualifies for an exemption and the duration of the exemption, and two, a list of healthcare services for which the exemption applies. Add Section I, that utilization review entities may not deny or reduce payment for healthcare service exempted from prior authorization unless the healthcare provider, one, knowingly misrepresented the healthcare service in a quest for payment with the specific intent to deceive and obtain an unlawful payment from a utilization review entity, or two, failed to substantially perform the healthcare service. Add Section J, which is the definition section, and adds Section 3, which provides for an immediate effective date.
Thank you. Before we go to our invited testimony, are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Telvin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to go to the definition section because I'm trying to wrap my brain around a utilization review entity. So I hear the word entity, I think of a group or a panel. But I see in the definition that on page 4, line 9, that an utilization review entity may be an individual or an entity, where I see the word entity to use describe the organization. So can you help me unpack what is the sponsor's intent when it says or establishes a utilization review entity? Is it really intended to be just a single individual or a panel, or what's kind of the pieces in there?
Yeah. Through the chair, for the record, Julia Fonoff, staff to Senator Wilson. If it's possible, may I defer to Senator Wilson as the chair?
As she's the one that will be enforcing, or her division.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Currently, the utilization review or independent review organizations, as we refer to them, we use them currently for when there's a dispute of for covered treatment or a denied claim. And they are generally peer groups that have the specialty, the knowledge of the procedures. We have, I think it's 10 on a rotating contract that when a request comes into our office, that we send them out to have it come back from the insurer, to have it come back and say yay or nay, the patient deserves or should have the treatment, or the insurance company is right to deny the treatment. And they are highly qualified. I don't believe we use any in the state. I can get you a list of who we have so you, and send it over to your office or send it to Senator Wilson through the committee. But they are peer groups that review should the patient have the procedure or the service or not. And they are not connected to the insurance company or directly to the patient.
Senator Tobin, follow up.
I'll follow up if that's all right. So maybe I have a wrong picture in my head. So I'm going to hope that you can help me clarify. So in your indication of these peer groups are sent out to evaluate particular services within their scope and understanding. And I see the word prior authorization, and I'm thinking something that's immediate, that you need a quick response. So I'm curious of how this intersects or how does this work together, as it seems like it's going to take time to gather a group and deploy them.
Through the chair, the groups are already organized. So they are already working, and they don't just work for the state of Alaska. They work for other states as well. So if it's an immediate need, our process is they have to respond to us within 24 hours for something that needs to be taken care of today. If it's otherwise, there are time frames, and I can send them over. But it's a pretty good process that we use on these. But right now, the way our statutes are, it's more for when a claim is denied or when the prior authorization is not given. There is not this way to get around the prior auth. So we do rely on these independent review organizations to say that the patient deserves or should have the treatment according to their policy.
Any further questions? Okay. Well, at this time, we'll go to our invited testifier. Seeing like we may have lost Dr. Kelly, just dropped off the line. But we do have Mr. Jeff Davis online. Jeffrey Davis. Mr. Davis, are you with us? If you can place yourself on the record and begin your invited testimony, please.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson. My name is Jeffrey Davis, and I am currently a Senior Vice President for Radiation Business Solutions. I provide consulting services to our clients as well as other healthcare organizations. But perhaps most relevant to this hearing is I've worked in various healthcare roles in Alaska since 1986, and I was the president of Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield Alaska from 1996 to 2013. Most recently, I've spent 5 years working on the provider side. So I am testifying as an interested person who hopefully can bring some perspective from both sides of this question, the payer side as well as the provider side. But in my view, Chairman Wilson, Senate Bill 219 is primarily about patient protection. It's not about payers or providers. The fact is that it is the patient that bears the cost of unnecessary delays from prior authorization, and it's very well documented that there are physical, emotional, and financial harms that happen from these delays in care. And yes, it does impact physicians and providers, but the patient impact is the most important. The original goals of prior authorization were to reduce unnecessary care and to provide quality assurance, et cetera, and they were very well-meaning. But what has happened over the last 40 years or so, really, is there's just been unchecked expansion of this tool, and it has become more of a problem than a solution. But it's very important for anyone listening to testimony on this bill or thinking about this bill that it does not eliminate prior authorization. Instead, it is intended to restore the balance, which has become very one-sided in favor of the payers. And if I might illustrate that, when a provider signs a contract to become part of a network with a payer, universally, that contract requires the provider to adhere to the utilization standards of the payer. And the contract also goes on to specify that the provider must comply with any changes that the payer puts in place, with really their only recourse is a full termination of the contract if they don't agree in most cases. So these provisions allow the payer to add additional layers of prior authorization, literally with no checks and balances, and that leaves the patients and providers to bear the burden of those additional layers. And the result has been ever-increasing levels of required mandates for prior authorization. In fact, recent studies by a number of entities have shown that providers actually spend 10 to 15% of their time on prior authorization. And if we think about that in terms of lost productivity and opportunity to see more patients, that's really significant. And that loss of productivity happens despite the fact that eventual approval rates are as high as 95%. I think it's important to point out, because you've heard testimony in other venues, that there are turnaround times that are required for prior authorizations to be approved. And there, I believe, current statute requires a 3-day turnaround, and that is true for a routine approval. The problem occurs when there's a denial, and unfortunately, denials are not a rare occurrence. In fact, in some specialties and with some payers, routinely recognized treatments are denied 100% of the time, because the payer has in mind that they would like to see perhaps a lesser expensive treatment regimen, where the provider has determined that the one that they have proposed is the best for their patient. And when that initial denial happens, it can be weeks and sometimes months, as Ms. Fano pointed out, before there is a final resolution and the care is received. And that's where the patients bear this responsibility. Bear the cost of the delay. So in my view, Senate Bill 219 restores balance to this relationship and this situation. And if a provider has been approved for a particular service 80% of the time, they are not the target of prior authorization, which is seeking to find providers who are doing things that are unnecessary or perhaps has been thrown out, fraud, and abuse. They are not the targets here. They've shown themselves to be proven, efficient, effective providers, and they're not at risk. So they should be exempt from this burden going forward. And finally, I would just point out that we have seen many instances of payers themselves implementing programs just like this. And I'd normally call the gold card program, where they exempt certain providers because they've met standards. And Senate Bill 219 is, in essence, essentially that same approach. It just puts it in statute so that individual providers don't have to seek that exemption themselves, which is costly and time-consuming. So thank you, Chairman Wilson and the committee, for allowing me to share my thoughts today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Davis? Seeing none, thank you for providing your invited testimony. I just want to make sure we still don't have Dr. Kelly. All right. At this time, we will go ahead and open up the public testimony. We'll start first here in the room in Juneau. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify on Senate Bill 219? Seeing none, we will go to the folks online on the off-net. First, we have Brenda Snyder, Director of Government Affairs from CVS Health. Ms. Snyder, if you can provide your public testimony and take about 5 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Brenda Snyder, State Government Affairs Director for Aetna, and I'm joining from Tacoma, Washington, and speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 219. Our subject matter expert, Mark Reese, is unavailable today, but he has testified twice in the House sharing our concerns on this bill, and we are happy to follow up after the hearing to answer any questions. We are in favor of innovative solutions to increase access to health care. However, Senate Bill 219 ignores the longstanding benefits of prior authorization and industry-wide practice that determines if certain care is necessary for each individual situation based on clinical guidelines set forth in criteria sets. SB 219 takes a far too broad approach, reducing the standards around prior authorization without considering the specific needs of the patient on the receiving end of the services. On average, Aetna approves 85 to 90% of all prior authorization claims. Additionally, we have implemented a provider differentiation program that some Alaska providers take part in, which allows for automated prior authorization for certain procedures, and we continue to evaluate ways to increase the use of our program to further ease the frustrations around prior authorization and truly differentiate those high-performing providers. SB 219 reduces the approval threshold to 80% without any threshold on the volume of procedures, eliminating any ability to ensure providers' particular expertise in a given procedure. We agree that we should aim for administrative simplification, but believe there are more creative and effective ways to drive simplicity without keeping the patient's safety and individual needs in mind. Senate Bill 219 is overly broad, and we respectfully ask for your opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder, for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we'll go to Pam. I'm not sure if you're online just for questions. Medigan from the Alaska State Medical Association, if you're just for questions or to provide public testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. I was both for questions, but I can also relay conversation that I had with Dr. Kelly since his last testimony on the prior authorization bill.
Hey, Pam?
If
you can just place yourself on the record, and then you...
I'm sorry. Thank you. Pam Benson, Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association. Dr. John Kelly is a neurologist in Alaska. He works both in Fairbanks and in Wasilla. He testified on the House side, I believe, last week about on this companion bill. And as a neurologist, he treats patients with multiple sclerosis. He referenced a patient who had given him permission to share briefly her case. She is a veterinarian in Alaska and very athletic and very active in competitive sports. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. The treatment of choice that could halt the progress of the disease was recommended, and they sought prior authorization. That prior authorization was denied, and they wanted her to go on a lesser effective medication regimen. It's called step therapy. That would she had to fail that treatment regimen before they would approve the better treatment option. The problem was that the step therapy medication could cause permanent damage. And this is a young woman who is very active
and a flare-up of her disease could have lifelong implications. Prior authorization has caused the delays resulting from prior authorization have caused patients to lose their vision. There are endless cases of patient harm due to the delays caused by prior authorization. Physicians have told me individually of the frustrations with prior authorization that they finally get to a peer-to-peer appeal, and they have to educate that reviewer on the standard of care and the reasoning behind why this medication or this procedure is the appropriate method of care. This has, though it started out many years ago to, you know, as a safety, a savings and cautionary mechanism, it has gone way out of bounds and is doing little but harming patients and costing more. It is not a cost-saving method anymore. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam, for your testimony this afternoon. Next up, we have Gary Strannigan. Gary, if you can place yourself on the record and take about 5 minutes to go through your public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Strannigan here from Primera Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alaska. Here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 219. Excuse me. And forgive me in advance. I'm struggling with a bit of a cold. I'd hoped to be with you in person today, but sparing you all of that exposure. So I want the committee to understand. I would like the committee to understand that health carriers, Primera, uses prior auth to apply downward pressure on waste, fraud, and abuse, which the American Medical Association estimates at about 25% of all medical spend in the United States of America. We are concerned that this bill will limit what effectiveness prior auth has as a tool at applying that downward pressure, and we would expect at the outset it to cost 2% in the markets in which it is in which the bill is effective. And it's also important for the committee to know that this bill is targeted at the individual market, the small group market, and the large group fully insured market. So effectively, the Chamber of Commerce crowd, as well as individuals and the not-for-profit community. So other lines of business like the state plan and the state health plan, state employee health plan, as well as ERISA plans are not directly affected under the wording of the bill. And that leads me to another problem that the bill creates for us, and that is it's our marketplace is it's about 11%. The size of the marketplace that this bill affects, about 11% of Alaskans. And in order to comply with this bill, we would have to make a pretty significant investment in IT infrastructure, programming, coding, that kind of thing, and spread it across this tiny market, which makes it very difficult to pencil out. And so in all likelihood, if the bill were to pass in its current form, we would probably stop doing prior auth altogether. Now, lest all the providers begin to cheer, we would instead do retrospective review, which means when a doctor or a provider performs services that are deemed medically unnecessary, they wouldn't get paid. And so it'll only take a little bit, once or two of those experiences, for them to start calling us, hey, if I do this, this is what's going on. If I do this service, will you pay me? And now we're back to an even worse place than we are right now. And so instead, what I would urge the committee is to consider following the lead of Washington State on this question. And that is, let's target the efficiency problems of the system. And there's no question that the prior auth system has had some glaring efficiency problems in its history. We see those problems improving as we speak. In Washington State, the prior auth turnaround times went from, in the bill, went from 5 days to 3 days. And I believe, to correct the what was said earlier, the existing standard for standard, the existing metric for standard turnaround times in Alaska is 5 days. So what we would suggest is take that down to 3 days. Washington's urgent turnaround time metric was 2 days. We moved it to 1 day, which is where Alaska's is now. On the condition that so these tighter turnaround times are made available to providers when they access a data portal using electronic means rather than fax. 55% of prior auths in Alaska in 2023 were initiated by a fax, and that just sets the process off on an antiquated footing and necessitates that it be manual and slow. So we would urge the Washington approach, and I would also just like to add, just for two other facts, we do have a Primera has a prior auth system in has a gold carding system in Alaska presently. And it is for providers that do excellent work. Their approvals, prior authorization approvals, are at a very high rate, and they do a lot of a particular procedure. So those offices are gold carded. What's ironic about it is sometimes they forget that they're gold carded and they submit the prior auth anyway. So the other thing that I think it's important for the committee to know is that we did a run of all of our data, both for Washington and Alaska, and we weren't able to break it out, but we don't see any reason why it would be different from one state to another. And we determined that of all claims, we used prior auth on 2.4% of them. And of all of those in the aggregate, after appeals and everything else, we deny 16.3% of the time. So of those 2.4%, 16.3% get denied. So anyway, we do see it being effective in terms of patient safety. We see it having patient safety benefits, and we see it having cost benefits as well. And we would like to see the system continue to improve. And we hope to work in good faith with this committee, with the proponents of the legislation, to see that happen.
Thank you, Ms. Drannigan. Are you available for questions?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
We have one from Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, actually. So the first is, with the Washington model, I'm curious, what's the enforcement mechanism? So you don't do it in 3 days, and then what? Do you automatically accrue a fine? Where's the fine paid to? How does that work? And then it also sounds like from the testimony we've gotten from the from some of the providers, is it's not just the front-end processing time. It's wrongful denials that then have to be fought and are very time-consuming, and then, you know, in some cases result in the decision being reversed. But I assume the Washington state model doesn't really address that, right? Because you'd still deny it, and then after 3 days, there'd be sort of a fight about it. Is that right?
Well, the enforcement mechanism in Washington is the insurance, the Office of the Insurance Commissioner. And as your own director of insurance can attest, they consider themselves very active protectors of the consumer. And So we are held to account in that respect. Forgive me, Mr. Chair. I didn't use the customary through the chair.
And do you want to follow up, Senator Dunbar, with the questions?
No, that's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else? Seeing no one else online, just check here in the room again. In Juneau, anyone else would like to testify on Senate Bill 219 before a closed public testimony? And for those listening online, we will you can submit your public comment to the Senate Test Committee through our email address at shss@akleg.gov to be included. We do have quite a few, a list of healthcare providers that have submitted their testimony that's uploaded on BASIS and in committee members' packets. This time we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And I will just state that as bill sponsor, we've been working with different insurers to try to come up with some compromises to this piece of legislation. One is looking at, we probably most likely will come up with a CS at a later time and date that we'll send to committee members and work with them on, as we would like to probably most likely raise the, Alaska would be the lowest state at the 80%, so we are looking at changing that to 90 to 95%, somewhere in that range, to work with committee members and to work as a brokerage with the insurance companies to make sure we're not the lowest. Another change that we were talking with providers and the insurance companies is that it would be a better process for them to list the entity instead of individual providers as a potential change to this piece of legislation. Also, listening to Mr. Shanigan about Premier and providers and not making it a mandate, but also including a sweetener for them because 50%, 55% of fax submissions is a little over cumbersome. And talking with providers, they feel that it's a simpler, easier complex instead of seeing using one system as a fax versus six different items to input into a web portal is a simpler, and they also get a fax confirmation easier than they do email confirmations. And so that's why a lot of providers that we've talked to prefer the fax item, because it seems to be an easier and simpler process for them to upload. But to if they do it by electronic, maybe to include the three-day turnaround for them would be a an item which would be an optional item, not a mandatory item for providers to do, was another change that we are looking at implementing. And I am going to forget, I'm trying to make sure that, I think that's the major ones that we were working on with some of the insurers and providers as possible changes, pieces of this legislation to let committee members know where the bill sponsor is heading at with changes to this piece of legislation. Are there comments or questions? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we didn't go over the fiscal note, but I'm just curious, as I see here in the fiscal note from the division, that the cost will be absorbed. And I'm just trying to make sure I wrap my brain around about what is the expected workload and to ensure that we are adequately accounting for that.
Yes. Well, we will ask the division director to talk upon the note that they have provided.
For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. And through the chair to Senator Tobin to her question, the way we do it right now is the insurers pay when there is the way we do our independent review now. And we would expect that to carry over for the independent review organizations. So we did a zero fiscal note because our time, other than the regulations that might be needed or the monitoring of the program, we feel we can absorb with current staff.
And also, we are looking to ask the the Department of Administration what this would take to implement Alaska Care. And I'll let Director Wing-Heyer explain why they do not see Alaska Care.
Through the chair, to Mr. Chairman's question, when the way Alaska Care is under separate statutes, Medicaid is under separate statutes, and then you've got Title 21 that deals with insured products. And more than once we get a bill that tries to put all three into one, and it becomes cumbersome. And Department of Administration is going to tell you that anything that touches their taking care of retirees, taking care of PERS, TERS, and on and on and on, that we try to implement from 21 could result in litigation that would be costly to the state as it impacts the retiree program, which is defined, I believe, in Constitution. So we can't extend it to Alaska Care as easily as we can to the Title 21, the 15% of Alaskans that are in that program. I'm not saying it can or can't be done somehow, but this bill right now does not go that far.
All right. Thank you, Director. Thank you. Are there further questions, comments? Seeing none, we will, is my intent to hold this bill for quite a while as we wait for hopefully the other companion, but we will hopefully bring this back up and try to do a CS so we can have further conversations and discussions on this piece of legislation. We'll ask amendments. If you have amendments, please let our office know by Wednesday, April 24th, and so we can work with committee members and hopefully get a CS before the committee and continue to work on this piece of legislation. That concludes our business for today. Our next, this upcoming Thursday, we'll hold a quick committee member, a bill to consider moving HCR 15 Mental Health Month, Tardive Dyskinesia Week, to this next committee of referral. And with that, is there any closing comments? We are adjourned at 4:31 p.m.